Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Robin Williams here. I've been bringing you The Science Show for 50 years, somehow.
And I'm Belinda Smith, the host of Lab Notes, the brand new sister show that gives you the latest discoveries in under 15 minutes.
Between us, we love all of science, old and new.
So whether you've got an hour or just a quarter of one,
we've got science covered. To hear us, search for The Science Show,
where you'll find both Lab Notes and Science Show. Go check it out.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal land, but this is an All-America show, a special report on the United States of America, its triumphs and its travails. In Washington, we bid au revoir to the east wing of the White House and wait breathlessly for the mighty ballroom that will rise on its ruins. More is at work here than the vulgarity of Donald Trump. Building big is all the vogue right now with the populist leaders of the world. From New York, we're hearing from queer thriller writer Andrea Bartz, who took to court the AI company that had stripped her books bare to feed its machines. She took them on, and she won, not only on her behalf, but for 500,000 authors who will now share $2 billion damages. But first, to sleepy Connecticut, where Bruce Shapiro is standing by to say a few words about the travails of President Trump. The people of New Jersey, Virginia, and New York have spoken loudly. Bruce, welcome back to the show.
Always good to be here.
Bruce, what does this mean?
It's been an extraordinary night for off-year elections. You know, usually off-year elections between a presidential election and midterms are about sleepy municipal races, mayoralities, and things like that. We've had a remarkable Democratic sweep in the last 24 hours. You know, we will talk, I'm sure, at length about Zohan Mamdani in New York City, the
Indeed.
Big headline of the night. But in some ways, the bigger news nationally is off-year elections in Virginia, where Democrats took back the governorship, swept out of office an attorney general, won down ballot races, knocking out Republicans in the state legislature. In New Jersey, where Representative Mikey Sherrill, a kind of liberal technocrat, more in the Hillary Clinton mode than the Mamdani or AOC mode, won the governorship. In Pennsylvania, where a series of judges targeted by Republicans held onto their seats, Democratic judges targeted by Republicans held onto their seats, all over the country, and then even in California, where redistricting to hold on to and grow the number of Democratic congressional districts, a move sparked by Governor Gavin Newsom in opposition to the Texas legislature's attempt to gerrymander Republican increases in Congress. All of these were Democratic sweeps across the board. You can even go to red states, to Georgia, where in down ballot races for things like county commissioner, Democrats prevailed in areas where they haven't in years. You don't want to read too much into these things, but it was very clear that across the board, the level of motivation, the level of pushback against the policies of the Trump administration, the roundups of immigrants, the cutting off of food aid lurking in the background of this is the government shutdown in which food stamps, which go to an eighth of Americans, are not going to be provided this month. You know, all of this swirling around has led to an unusual off-year Democratic wave, which you got to think has Republicans in Congress who thus far have followed Donald Trump anywhere he will go, some of them are going to be thinking, if they're in vulnerable districts, what do I do now?
What about me? They might be starting to think. But, Bruce, I know we must always be cautious, and caution is the byword of Late Night Live. We never make extravagant predictions. It's just not in our nature. But this is interesting, is it not? Because opinion polls don't necessarily suggest that Trump is in much trouble. In fact, for many people looking at the United States of America, one of the most troubling things is that Trump is doing all this muck, but the people still seem to be, you know, more or less going along with it. But when they come to the ballot box, it's very different.
Yes. Well, and the question always is what's going to happen at the ballot box. The numbers on President Trump are conflicted. His personal approval ratings, the ratings, the percentages of people blaming him for the shutdown, disapproving of the immigrant policy, all of those have him kind of in the tank. He's in trouble with those. What haven't moved too much so far are the percentages of people in polls who talk about how they would vote. But that's very abstract. What we're seeing this year, anyway, is a really highly motivated Democratic electorate in a number of these districts. And we're still looking at the numbers, right? But in a number of these districts in Virginia, New Jersey, elsewhere, Democratic candidates this year ran way ahead of Kamala Harris's numbers in the presidential election. In a number of cases, Democratic and voter participation generally is way up. In New York City, for instance, we saw the largest voter turnout in any municipal election since 1969. Now, I was 10 years old in 1969. That was a long time ago. That was also the first time the New York Mets, whose colors are Zohan Mamdani's campaign colors, parenthesis, won the World Series. Okay.
Thanks, Bruce. That's a really useful way of us telling how time has passed. Yes, keep going on.
But you do have to go back a long time in New York City history and in the history of Virginia and in the history of New Jersey to see an electorate motivated in an off-year election as powerfully as this year. What secured Donald Trump's victory last year wasn't just his own gains, though there were some of those. A lot of it was Democratic voter fall off in participation by people disillusioned by politics or people who simply felt profoundly dissatisfied or just plain unmotivated by either of the presidential campaigns.
And isn't there polling that shows, or some investigations that shows, if those Democrats who didn't bother to turn out to vote had actually gone to vote, the result for Trump would have been even more resounding?
This is one of these speculative exercises, and a lot of it depends on which part of the country you're talking about. But at a minimum, the margins for Trump in a number of swing states would have been much smaller if people had turned out to vote for Democrats.
Right? Yeah.
Previous Democratic voters. I mean, look, even in I'm talking to you from New Haven, Connecticut, a profoundly Democratic city, and in this city last year, 5,000 fewer people voted than had voted in the presidential election of 4 years earlier, right? If that trend changes, if what we saw on election day 2025 prevails going into the midterms and going into the next presidential cycle, it's going to be a very different story. That doesn't mean that the ills of American politics are solved, but it does suggest we are seeing some possibility of new degrees of motivation, new ways of organizing. Something has changed to move more people to the polls than we would typically see.
Well, some things have definitely changed in New York. Tell us about Mamdani.
What I found most interesting about Mamdani's quite substantial victory by over 10 points over Andrew Cuomo was his Mamdani's uncompromising articulation of his own principles when he came out to give his victory speech. He began his victory speech by quoting Eugene V. Debs, the patron saint of American democratic socialism, a railroad workers union leader and socialist party leader who ran for president on an anti-war ticket from jail in 1918. Okay. He quoted cited Jesse Jackson, FDR. He did not at all apologize for running against Cuomo. In fact, he talked about defeating a political dynasty. And he really went out of his way to speak as an immigrant himself at a time when immigrant communities in an immigrant city are under attack. He also overwhelmingly captured a youth vote, a huge percentage of his high voter turnout were young voters. And he spoke specifically about the economic choices that young voters have been making. He's been laser focused on affordability as a key campaign issue. And that came up again and again and again in his speech, right? It was a very unusual campaign in his own gifted practice of retail politics and in a grassroots volunteer effort that got something like 80,000 door knockers and other campaign volunteers motivated. Again, outside the usual Democratic Party apparatus, you saw some major Democratic figures like Senator Chuck Schumer sit on their hands and not come out for him, right?
God, he must feel like a winner tonight. Good on you, Chuck. Well done.
Chuck is in an interesting position. Senator Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, on the one hand has infuriated probably large numbers of his own electorate in New York City. On the other hand, he would say, I think, that he's responsible for fundraising for Democrats all over the country, and there are many Democratic donors who are still really worried about having someone who's a Democratic socialist and who champions Palestinian rights as the mayor of New York City.
But isn't that the thing? I mean, I watched that victory speech as well. I was puzzled by the huge roar Mamdani got for saying that we have toppled a political dynasty. The sense of rage at Cuomo seemed to be very powerful in the audience.
It was powerful in the audience, and it was unusual in an American politician in a victory speech to hear no quarter asked nor given to his defeated opponent.
Yes.
He said, I wish him well in private life, and this is going to be the last time I'm going to speak his name.
Right? That was extraordinarily brutal.
And I think that speaks to the bitterness of the campaign between these two men, in which Cuomo, the former governor, forced out of office on sexual harassment charges, repeatedly mispronounced deliberately Mamdani's name and accused him of being anti-Semitic and played all kinds of bigotry cards. And it was quite interesting to see Mamdani essentially saying, we're turning the page on this, but I'm not making peace with it.
But there you have Chuck Schumer sitting on his hands because he's got to raise the money. And it appeared from that victory speech and from the campaign itself, I don't know whether you would agree with this, that what Mamdani is saying is we are up against money. And we have power at the ballot box, but our enemy here are the elites who are pushing up rents, the elites who are making life in this town too expensive. The enemy there is money, and this is going to be very hard for the Democratic Party, isn't it?
Well, it's hard in American politics generally, right? You have to remember that the U.S. Supreme Court, now 20 years ago, declared that money is speech.
That was a good move, wasn't it? Wasn't that
right,
a good
and
move?
And to a great extent, campaign spending is virtually unlimited. Amdani himself has raised a lot of money. AOC, Alejandra Ocasio-Cortez, is the biggest fundraiser in the U.S. Congress.
So is she?
Socialists,
how
yes, she is. So socialists, the biggest Democratic fundraiser, I should say. Socialists in American politics know something about raising money themselves, but it is absolutely true that in this victory speech, as in his campaign, Mamdani articulated a kind of pure Bernie Sanders anti-elite, anti-oligarch version of democratic socialism. Now, it should be said that this democratic socialism is an American strain. It's essentially European social democracy, right? We're not talking about Joseph Stalin here, right?
we're not going to strip the rich of their fortunes. We might try to get them to pay some tax.
Yeah, it's really about harnessing the labor movement and the energies that sparked the New Deal and the Great Society, continuing the American tradition of redistributionism, right? But that it's also been very much a tradition among more conservative American politicians to demonize that and to try to sort of tar it with the anti-communist, anti-socialist brush. And you've certainly heard lots of that. You heard it from Cuomo, from Republican Curtis Sliwa, who got 7% of the vote that otherwise might have gone to Cuomo.
Who came out to Australia to do some quite good work 30 years ago. He tried to set up a vigilante operation in Sydney. It failed, of course, and so he went back to America. He was wearing a red beret even then.
He wore it tonight.
God, he must be bald. Is he incredibly bald under that beret? But Bruce, seriously for a moment, are these string of defeats across America for Trump going to change him in any way? Will he look at these and think, well, maybe I should restore Obamacare. Maybe I should,
They're not going to change Donald Trump. He has one mode of politics, right? And his one mode of politics is disruption and authoritarianism. The question is, will it split his supporters in Congress? Will it change the Republican Party? Will it change any Republican office holders, particularly those in suburban and swing districts, who can read an election like this and know the distress of their constituents, even though they themselves have been unafraid, they've been too frightened, too intimidated to break with the president?
They've gone along with everything.
We are now in the middle of a government shutdown. Right, a government shutdown in which, as I said, 1 out of 8 Americans have lost their food stamps. In my own city in New Haven, that's 1 in 5 residents get food assistance from the federal government. In which flights, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, flights are now getting delayed. The pain of the government shutdown is beginning to ripple out. And if you look at polls, people are, for the most part, blaming President Trump and blaming Republicans. What happens tomorrow when Republicans sit down and have conversations with themselves quietly? Do they begin to walk away a bit from the president, or do we just keep doubling down on the ICE raids and the arrests and the dragging of people across the floor of jails? Do we double down on taking away food stamps and on not paying furloughed federal workers, who, by the way, were a substantial part of the federal workers are a substantial part of that Virginia electorate that took the governorship away from the Republican Party?
All to be discussed, Bruce, when we next have you back on Late Night Live. Thank you.
To be continued.
Thank you for joining us in these dramatic circumstances. I have, of course, been speaking to Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor at The Nation and executive director of the Global Center for Journalism and Trauma. Bruce, thanks.
As always.
Coming up, the ballroom in Donald Trump's mind. Holding a banquet in a tent has a charm someone like Donald Trump can't possibly grasp. The Obamas loved doing it, held five state banquets on the South Lawn, black tie, under canvas, and even one summer night in 2011 had a banquet for Angela Merkel under the stars. But that's not Trump. He needs pillars, marble and chandeliers. So he's torn down the East Wing to build a ballroom. It's going to be big. 16 times bigger than the chamber at Windsor Castle, where he ate in September. That night, only 160 guests sat down with him and the King. His ballroom will seat 650. This, as my next guest, Jan Werner Müller, pointed out in The Guardian recently, is a global trend right now. Populist leaders celebrating themselves by building spectacular buildings. Jan Werner Müller is Professor of Politics at Princeton University. Jan, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you very much for having me on the program.
Jan, tinkering with the White House is an old presidential routine. Lots of them have done it.
So, yes, there have been now many discussions about how many, many presidents have done things. Sometimes, like Truman, even had to do things because the place was literally falling apart. But in terms of size, in terms of changing the basic structure, this is pretty much unprecedented. And as Trump himself has always said, to some degree, this is also really on one level about demonstrating, you know, what makes him special as a developer. And if I may add, it also in a sense is about demonstrating power and simply creating facts, putting in place a structure that will not be easily undone if it's ever undone.
I haven't compared the footprints of the new wing that's being built with the old White House. But it looks as though this ballroom is actually going to have a bigger footprint than the White House itself.
That has been reported. And given that architecture inevitably always also has a symbolic meaning, it of course does make a strange impression to say that, okay, the ballroom seems somehow now more important than, you know, the core functions of government. Plus, as everybody has been saying rightly, it is also extremely problematic to have the whole thing financed by private donors. Of course, they're trying to run a story that says, oh, look, you know, this saves some taxpayers' money. But there's a reason why we don't use private money for public buildings, because it obviously creates an impression of corruption. And as everybody knows by now, there is indeed also a reality of corruption in the United States after Trump came back into office. So that's also a very problematic aspect of this whole endeavor.
The decor of the plan. Lots of chandeliers, gold, of course, quite a lot of gold detailing. Corinthian columns. I wonder, Jan, whether the Corinthian order is the order for despots.
I think we should be careful to equate particular styles with one particular tendency. It was very common to do that when you look at, you know, the sort of worst examples of 20th century totalitarian architecture. People said, look, you know, so-called stripped neoclassicism, that was the architecture of Albert Speer and Hitler. But it's a really more complicated picture. There was also, for instance, a lot of very good modernist architecture in fascist Italy. Even in Germany, there were actually some buildings that actually look pretty modern. I think what is odd about Trump, when you think about it, is that, of course, he has already issued a number of executive orders where he basically decrees from on high, classicism is our style. You know, this is what the United States is about. His own buildings, for that matter, are actually sort of quite bland in their modern style. And it's only on the inside that you have, as you said, all this kind of wannabe Versailles, or as some American critics have now been calling it, regional car dealership Rococo, which I think is a very nice way of putting it.
It's brutal.
In terms of this completely garish. It's the nation's architecture critic, Kate Wagner. So, you know, credit where credit is due, who came up with this idea.
But Jan, to declare that the classical style is American, this is the American style, is not altogether wrong, is it? Because you can look, you know, there is the White House, there are those antebellum mansions in the Deep South, there is the Supreme Court. Again and again, these are classical buildings, and they are the sort of icons of American architecture.
Yes, with, if you allow me, three small caveats. So, number one, Those who originally opted for the style, so Thomas Jefferson, for instance, were also very keen to say, let's not make this too grand and pompous. They wanted something that looked small R Republican, you know, a kind of the citizen ideally as agrarian person, self-reliant, maybe even with a weapon, not something that looked too much like an ostentatious palace. And if you look at Jefferson's own designs, he actually submitted a design for the White House under a pseudonym. It's really not like the ballroom at all. So that's point number one. Point number two, as you also said, there is also a distinct association with the South. In a sense, this is also a legacy that has to be factored in. One can't pretend that that doesn't exist. And thirdly, I think there's a good argument to be made for, well, we do live in different times now. You also have an opportunity to make different gestures with architecture. Many classical buildings in their own way can be quite bland. If you look at many things that have been built in that style, let's say regional courthouses in the US, they're not particularly interesting. So I'm not saying that, you know, this somehow should be prohibited as a style. But I think we should also not automatically default into it and then accept it simply because somebody decrees this is the American way.
And a decree that public buildings have got to be built in a particular style is just ludicrous. I mean, and very much the whim of a dictator, wouldn't you say?
So it's certainly problematic if somebody decrees artistic aesthetic choices from on high. It fits into a larger global pattern where it's for shorthand right-wing populists in particular who basically have tried to communicate something about how they understand what they often call the real people or the proper people. So some kind of image of what, you know, the ideal American or let's say the ideal Hungarian or the ideal Turk looks like, what kind of traditions they draw on. So a lot of these figures have used buildings to convey a message about that. They've also tried to convey the message that in many cases they've won, you know, big majorities at the polls. They put something out there that cannot be undone easily. It's a way of telling also the opposition and other citizens, look, you know, we've really done it. We're here now, you know, we're putting this in your face and you can't do anything about it.
And also that they are authentic. Isn't that part of the claim that these buildings make? I, the builder of that building, I am showing you that I am authentic because I'm drawing on the traditions of the country. I'm asserting all of these kind of half-familiar tropes or very familiar tropes of architecture. I represent you.
Very clear answer on my part, yes and no. So yes, in the sense that these figures do say that they and only they represent what they often call the real people. So I completely agree that that's part of the package. But the no consists in pointing out that, as a matter of fact, a lot of them, of course, are not actually in any way faithful to, let's say, original building methods. Very, very many of them are basically about decoration, which is another way of saying you build something with concrete and then you basically put something on it.
Yes.
That gestures at the past. But it's really not, you know, a faithful reconstruction of anything by any stretch of the imagination.
Despots can build well, can't they? I'm thinking.
It depends.
I'm thinking, you know, Rome, St. Petersburg, London at various stages, appalling governments, beautiful architecture.
Again, I think we should be careful of how we link politics and architecture. So you're right that we can't say that, oh, just because it was built under a more or less authoritarian regime, therefore it must be bad architecture, or that anything built under democracies is necessarily better. But it also depends what then people make of these buildings.
So, yes,
you know, you can find many examples where something has been built, even with a quite clear and obvious authoritarian intention, but then the people themselves were able to appropriate the building, change the meaning of the building. That's also true, for instance, of cities, of big squares, which, you know, as you know, authoritarians also like to have soldiers, you know, march up and down, demonstrate power. But, you know, people have some power over how these edifices are being read and interpreted.
And even by coming to love them, they can change their meaning. Because in a sense, those buildings then become genuinely part of the tradition of that country. So that, you know, very beautiful buildings in London, something like the Banquet House or something, built by James I, who's not the worst leader Britain's ever had, but it becomes loved and therefore part of the nation.
Yes, things clearly change over time. We also shouldn't forget that the sometimes very heated debates around the choice of, let's say, styles are often forgotten. So it's long forgotten that, you know, since you brought up Britain in the 19th century after the House of Commons had burned down, House of Parliament had burned down, there was this incredible debate about should we rebuild in the Gothic style or classical. In those days, classical was rejected because it was seen as revolutionary, was associated with the French and the American revolutions. I think few people would remember that today and, you know, sort of say, well, you know, what if we, you know, rebuilt in classical? How would that have changed, you know, our understanding of history?
I think the world is pretty happy with the result of the Palace of Westminster, don't you think?
Absolutely. The only thing, as everybody knows, is falling apart, and it's been fiendishly difficult to try to renovate it.
That's right. It's just sinking into the river. On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm speaking to the Professor of Politics at Princeton University, Jan Venemüller, about the world trend at the moment for populist leaders to be building architecture of a certain style. Jan, Erdogan in Turkey seems to be sort of almost the poster boy of this trend. Yet when I look at the buildings he's building, they don't seem to me to be particularly sort of Turkish. They're sort of very substantial, but not sort of folkloric in any way.
Well, I might slightly disagree. I think if you look at his presidential palace in Ankara, I think it was clearly gesturing at a so-called Ottoman Seljuk style. It was also another enormous grand building. It sort of violated all kinds of environmental laws, a little bit like Trump is constantly violating laws. But above all, I think Erdogan has been very keen to build, you know, very large mosques. There's now one that is absolutely gigantic in Istanbul. You basically see it from almost anywhere in the city. He built a new airport. As soon as you exit that airport, you see a fairly large mosque. So I think it's not an accident that with someone like Erdogan in Turkey, or let's say Modi in India, where, again, going back to our earlier discussion, there's a sort of the understanding of the people as, let's say, primarily or maybe even exclusively Muslim or as Hindu, that actually the main emphasis is on temples, mosques. It's not always, strictly speaking, government buildings that are most important for these kinds of leaders.
It seems to me really fascinating that the man that Trump has hired to build this monstrous ballroom, his real sort of practice is in building churches.
The story, as it has been reported, abounds in ironies. So he was initially a pupil, if that's the right word, of Peter Eisenman, the famous American architect who was one of the main protagonists of so-called deconstructivist architecture, the very thing that Trump's latest executive order decreeing style explicitly condemns, that it says it's disorder, it's problematic, things should never be built this way. But then apparently he had a revelation and he disowned that particular approach and then turned to specializing in religious buildings. It's been reported that his old mentor, Peter Eisenman, looked at some of the designs and with unmatched condescension, you might say, called them untutored. Of course, we don't know what exactly will be built in the end, but quite a few people have looked at whatever has been revealed about the designs and have noticed some flaws or some very incoherent sort of approaches about where windows and stairs are and so on. So you might even say, in a weird way, if it stays that incoherent, even though it wasn't meant to be deconstruction, it might actually end up at this inadvertently.
Yes. Waiting in the wings is Trump's plan to build a triumphal arch in Washington. Are you as excited about that as I am?
So we don't know quite how bad this will be in the end. Again, it's entirely fitting with his approach, and it is in a sense a sign of autocratic ambitions. At the same time, again, forgive me for being pedantic, we should not be too quick. You know, it's almost forgotten that, you know, a perfectly democratic French president, François Mitterrand, in the 1980s also had a lot of so-called grand projects in those days. and wanted to kind of leave an imprint on the city. So I think we should not immediately now jump up and down every single time that, you know, Trump floats an air of what he wants to build. But the details are telling, and I think the details should be condemned, the proportions should be condemned, and basically ignoring laws and violating existing regulations should also be condemned.
There are leaders who, as you say, would have loved to build, would have loved to fix their cities, do great things like that, but feared to do so because of the political consequences of spending so much money, of making such changes. One of the things about Trump is that he seems not to fear any of the consequences of this, let alone the possibility that it will make him a joke.
It's true that what is distinctive about especially the second term is that, unlike in other countries where many leaders try to at least keep up a facade of legality and actually invested quite a lot of time and energy into fooling outside observers into thinking that, yeah, everything was done legally and correctly, Trump as president acts pretty much like Trump the businessman in New York City, which is to say, do something that is obviously illegal. And everybody knows it's illegal. But basically, then you sort of wait and see what happens. Do other people arrange themselves? Are they actually going to go to court? Might they settle outside of court? So that is really quite distinctive. And of course, it's then sold to his followers as, look, he's so decisive. He actually does stuff. And it's true, alas, that of course, on one level, yes, he is creating facts. You cannot easily undo certain things. And in that sense, he sort of remains the person, as we nowadays like to say, driving the narrative, being at the center of attention and so on. And that is, of course, its own form of power.
Jan, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I've been talking to Jan Werner Müller, professor of politics at Princeton University, about the latest buildings of Donald Trump. Coming up, the writer who took on AI and won. Perhaps they thought they could keep it secret, but a couple of years ago, Atlantic magazine listed hundreds of thousands of books, histories, novels, textbooks, the lot, that had been fed into AI's large language models. With a few keystrokes, writers could find if they were among the robbed. One of the robbed was New York-based queer thriller writer Andrea Bartz. She and some fellow writers then began a class action against the AI company responsible for the theft of their work, Anthropic. The result is the biggest payout ever in a United States copyright dispute. In Australian dollars, $2.28 billion to 500,000 authors. Perhaps it's a model for the world. Andrea Bartz joins me from the United States. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me.
Pleased with the result?
I mean, yes, I think the settlement is fair. I think it's a first step, and I think it's a really important one in an industry that has, you know, not really faced any regulation until now.
What were the companies, the AI companies, actually doing?
Sure. So in the case of Anthropic, they knew that they needed tons and tons and tons of data in order to train their algorithm, in order to make it quote unquote smart. And so they needed high quality content. And some other people had stolen all of our books and, you know, made them in digital form and just put them on the internet for anyone to take, really making it clear that these were pirated. This was not, you know, this was a little bit shady legally, but here's the stuff. So we now know from discovery that some people at Anthropic saw that, discussed it, decided it was sort of worth the risk of just taking it, and they fed that into their algorithm in order to create an early version of what would eventually become Claude, their chatbot. So it was a way of learning how to use data to actually create, you know, a product that's now familiar to a lot of people as something you can kind of chat with.
But the first step was the theft by somebody else. Somebody who,
that's correct.
Somebody who had taken a hard copy of the book and put it on the internet.
What they probably did was take an ebook and sort of strip it of the stuff that makes it non-copyable and then upload that as a file, sort of strip it down to a TXT file, and then upload that into this huge data set of hundreds of thousands of books.
Did it make a difference to the legal outcome here that that shenanigans was at the start of the process? Would the outcome have been different if this company had just gone to just a book firm, bought a download, and taken it from there?
So that's a really interesting question, because the judge in this case, and of course there are dozens of different, you know, copyright lawsuits against AI companies that are working their way through the courts now, and so this is just one. In the case of this lawsuit, the judge declared that, you know, if they had obtained this stuff legally and used that to train their algorithm, that would be fine. And indeed, what Anthropic did, which I think shows sort of their culpability, if anything, is that after they had spent some time learning from, you know, this algorithm they'd created and this large language model, they said, this feels a little sketchy that we did this on pirated books. This might get us in trouble down the line. And so they paid tons of money for people to go out and buy hundreds of thousands of books in mostly used form. So again, the authors didn't see a dollar, but they picked up used books. And then they paid people to take an X-Acto knife to strip the spine from the books and to scan them page by page for the entirety of the book in order to create a, quote, digital library. Now, the judge in this case declared that that was fair use and that was not considered making an illegal copy because they bought one copy and were left with one digital copy. I strongly disagree with that for a number of reasons, but that was what happened in the case of this one lawsuit.
Right. So that this magnificent settlement that you've won doesn't actually establish that the AI companies can't gobble up a legally obtained copy of someone's work.
That's correct. So this settlement is exclusively about the theft, the pirated books that they took and that they used. I mean, I'm very hopeful that, again, this is a first step, and I'm very hopeful that there's going to be other lawsuits and other rulings that sort of jibe with our sensibilities and, you know, rationality a little bit more. But in this case, this is not forward thinking. Another important thing to note is that this doesn't give them any future permission to continue. They have to destroy that trove of pirated books, and that doesn't give them permission to use those ebooks in particular. So it's not a license. It's not moving forward in that sense.
Right.
But you are correct that the judge declared it fair use for them to take legally obtained books and feed them in.
It's a complicated area. Andrea, let's go back. What was your what was your response when you found your books there?
I felt incredibly violated. I felt like my most sort of intimate possession, my, you know, intellectual property had been stolen from me. And there was something just additionally infuriating about the fact that, you know, as you mentioned, it was just one of hundreds of thousands that got gobbled up by this algorithm in a fraction of a second. You know, it really bothers me if somebody steals one of my books from, you know, a pirated source because they want to listen to it on audiobook and they don't want to pay for it. But this is like an algorithm spent a fraction of a second on it. And I worked for, you know, 5 or 10 years on it. I poured my heart and soul into it. I did deep thinking and a lot of feeling and, you know, expressing vulnerability. You know everything it takes to write a book. So just knowing that it had been stolen for these purposes of making a big tech company unfathomably wealthy and to create this algorithm that could ultimately compete on the market with my works was infuriating on every level.
You must have moved very quickly to start a court action because not a lot of time has passed.
It's pretty remarkable. I reached out to the law firm that had been one of the law firms involved in the OpenAI suit with authors, which is still working its way through the courts. But that one is quite famous. It has a lot of sort of blockbuster name brand authors attached as named plaintiffs. I had reached out because I was ticked off, like you said, and wanted to be just involved. And so it wasn't until somebody from Anthropic actually spoke about how they had used one of these databases that the law firm reached back out and said, you know, I think there's a case here. Would you be interested in suing, basically? So I signed on with really no idea that it was going to become a landmark suit and in some ways, you know, gallop ahead of some of the other litigation that was already working its way through the courts. But it was an unexpected speed, but it was, you know, an outcome that I really hoped for and felt was necessary.
It certainly galloped ahead because, you know, you have a settlement now and it's only a year or so down the track. These cases can go on for 10 years. Is it because the AI company realized they had made that terrible little mistake at the start that they were never going to be able to defend? And the best thing to do, though it seems a huge amount of money, the best thing to do was to just get this off the books?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'm not really able to speculate on what was going on in the minds of the defendants, right? But, you know, there was a really highly motivated judge who was really engaged in the topic and was kind of the one challenging everyone to keep moving forward. There were lawyers putting in an incredible amount of work. And I suspect, though I can't prove that what you're saying is correct, I don't imagine Anthropic would settle or come to the table to discuss a settlement if the writing wasn't on the wall. And, you know, from where I sit, I think what they did was quite egregious, and it was sort of the best outcome for everyone.
But the judge seems to have said that if they'd paid Amazon Books $10 to get a legitimate downloaded copy, they might then have been able to argue that they turned that book into something else, and that therefore they had something of their own that they could defend the existence of, that they had transformed your work into something else. Is that what the judge was hinting at?
Yeah, that was my understanding of the judge's declaration that, you know, the work was transformative, and so it is considered fair use to feed a legally obtained work of art into the algorithm. Obviously, I disagree. I'm hopeful that in the future that there's going to be more clarity on that, because I don't think it's right personally.
There seems to be an argument in this country, and I don't know whether it cropped up in your case, that copyright law defends the physical expression of things. And if an AI company gobbles up your book and puts it out in some other form, then only your ideas have been taken, and anybody can read your book. Read your book and take those ideas. So can an AI company take your ideas and make something else of them? Is that an argument that came up in your litigation?
Yeah. So from reading sort of the judge's decisions about parts of the lawsuit that he was throwing out, that was one of them, where he compared an AI algorithm, a large language model, gobbling up all of our books to a school child who is going to read lots of different books and then sort of learn from them in order to create their own books and their own writing in the future. I think the differences between the two are so obvious and apparent, and I don't agree with that decision at all, but it is part of the judge's logic in declaring it fair use. They're not spitting out the exact same thing as your book, and so how is it different from somebody reading a bunch of books to learn from them and learn to write their own books?
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live, and I'm David Marr, and my guest is the thriller writer Andrea Bartz. Andrea, how did you acquire how many 100,000 fellow litigants here?
So this being a class action, it sort of goes in the other direction. So something I do want to clarify is that both authors and publishers are part of the class.
Indeed.
And so it's a big group with a lot of parties. The reason that we ended up with this 500,000 is that In Discovery, we learned that the books pulled from the works, they call them the works pulled from the internet, scraped from the internet, pulled from that a pirated database and fed into the algorithm, number about 500,000. So it wasn't until the works list was released, which just happened, I believe, at the beginning of the month or maybe last month, that people even found out if their books were in it or not. There's no guarantee that if your book is in the Atlantic's searchable database, for example, that Anthropic actually stole it. So with this being a class action suit, we are representing everyone who had their work stolen, but we didn't even know exactly who that would entail until the process of discovery. So that was how we ended up representing close to, I think it's 482,000 works.
And how much is everybody going to get of this huge settlement?
What we're hearing is that the number should be somewhere around $3,000 per work, and how that will be divided between the author and the publisher will sort of depend on the category that the work is in. So, for example, I'm a trade author. I imagine you are as well. In most cases, that means that at least here in the States, we signed contracts saying that if our copyright was infringed and both parties proceed jointly, the publisher and the author, that any damages would be split. So the default is going to be 50-50 for trade authors. But that's only a default. And if people's contracts say something different, they can make the case for something different.
But Andrea, you're a writer. How much time have you lost by throwing yourself into this litigation?
Oh, my goodness. I need to never, ever think about my hourly rate on this because, you know, it's I had to put on hold all of my other work. I had to miss my other deadlines. I had to stop working on my next novel. And for 5 or 6 weeks, I was doing 40 or 50 hours a week. Of just meetings and writing things and reviewing things and talking to different stakeholders. So the sort of, you know, finish line was really, really intense.
But it's more than time, isn't it? It just, to be involved in litigation just absorbs all of your attention.
I did not expect the sort of emotional and cognitive toll of being involved in it. It's sort of cognitively draining at every turn. And it was a really important and personal case to me. I cared so much about, you know, my books, all the other books that were stolen. And so I and the other two lead plaintiffs who, you know, Charles Graber and Kirk Wallace Johnson, they put in exactly as much work as I did. The three of us really wanted to get it right. And so I don't ever need to be a lead plaintiff again. It was exhausting, but I'm really glad I was able to do this.
This is an important step, this case. And a large sum of money is being paid to a large number of authors. But what seems a large sum of money to us is not actually much money to the company you were suing. I'm wondering whether in the AI world, cases like this are just a business expense.
It's a great question. And, you know, I completely understand that kind of thinking and the, oh, this is a speeding ticket or you should have held out for more or you should have, you know, gone to trial for it. I hear all of that. But I think it's really important that we got this first step. And if we had gone to trial, we A, could have lost, but B, even if we had won, it's entirely possible that nobody would have seen a dime in the class.
Congratulations on your victory.
Thank you so much.
I've been talking to Andrea Bartz, queer thriller writer. Her latest book is called The Last Ferry Out, and she was one of the driving forces behind this immense litigation against an AI company that has been robbing about 500,000 writers of their work. And that's the show. On our next, we check to see if the thinking that brought down Gough Whitlam 50 years ago is still alive in the mind of the coalition. Any regrets? Would they do it all over again? I'll be talking to the opposition's nominated spokesman on November the 11th, former Shadow Attorney General Julian Lisa.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.